Israeli embassy in the capital Amman for a sixth consecutive night, calling on their government to cancel all treaties and ties with Israel. Israeli military has launched new aerial and ground attacks on Gaza's death toll from nearly 6 months of onslaught on the besieged strip continues to mount. Israeli warplanes have once again targeted the central city of Deir al-Balah, as well as Rafah in the south. Civil defense crews and paramedics are struggling to recover the wounded from bombed-out buildings due to a lack of equipment. Heavy fighting is also underway in the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital, located in Gaza City. The war in Gaza, that started back in early October, has so far left more than 32,600 Palestinians dead, most of them women and children. Israeli attacks on Gaza have also wounded over 75,000 people. The Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics said in a recent report that 70% of the homes in Gaza are now uninhabitable. At least 100 more Palestinians are killed in the past 24 hours in Israel's unrelenting bombing and shelling campaign in Gaza. The regime continues pounding the besieged territory in defiance of UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire.
And the elderly, people who are not at fault in this war. They are innocent people. We are talking about children. This is a little girl. What has she done wrong?
They were asleep and unaware of anything. Mr. Kamal was an English teacher who has been an educator his whole life. They had no hand in anything. But the enemy's planes mercilessly bombed the house, leaving no one alive in the family. The children were asleep. Look, he's sleeping like this, like he always does. They targeted the house while they were inside.
The home houses more than 50 people, four or five families, including mostly children and women, civilian residents confined to their apartments. A rocket was dropped on their four-story building without prior warning or notice.
Those who died, all of them were children, women, and elderly. There is just one child. The rest were all infants, 1 month to 4 months. This is not a war. This is extermination. Trees, animals, houses, universities, schools, children, and women are all being exterminated.
Israeli forces continue pressing ahead with their genocidal onslaught on Gaza, leaving more death and destruction throughout the besieged territory. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier from central Gaza to give us the latest on the situation.
Actually, the Israeli occupation forces continued and maintained their airstrikes and attacks against several areas of Gaza Strip. Over the last night, those attacks were intensified against Gaza City. And as you know, that the current brutal Israeli aggression is still continued against Al-Shifa Medical Complex and the surrounding areas of the complex that were subjected to heavy bombardments of the Israeli airstrikes. Several and cruel Israeli airstrikes targeted the residential buildings there amid heavy gunfire and constant shelling of the Israeli tanks. Needless to mention that the eastern part of the city, particularly Azzatoun neighborhood, also was targeted by constant Israeli shelling. And when it comes to Khan Yunis city, as you know, the current situation is still catastrophic and dreadful, as the Israeli aggression is still maintained against the western part of the city, including the vicinity of the Nasser Medical Complex and the Al-Amal Hospital. As over the last night, the Israeli war, with the Israeli occupation forces continued targeting and blowing up more residential squares and buildings. It is the same policy for the Israeli occupation forces to use starvation and famine as a weapon of war against the Palestinian people. This means that Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip is still deprived of having any real access to those basic humanitarian aid and needs. The Israeli occupation forces are still rivaling and stalling the delivery of those humanitarian needs to those people, knowing that 700,000 Palestinian civilians are still trapped in those areas. In addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces deliberately and intentionally target the Palestinian popular communities and committees that were formed in order to secure and to organize the process of delivering those humanitarian aid to the people. As you know, that yesterday the Israeli occupation forces committed an appalling massacre after targeting the those members in Ash-Shuja'iyya Club, 17 Palestinian civilians, including many police officers and police members in Gaza, who were supposed to protect and to secure those humanitarian aid in order to be delivered to the needy people inside Gaza.
The International Court of Justice on Thursday issued an order for Israel to take all necessary and effective measures to ensure that basic supplies arrive in Gaza without delay. Let's listen to reactions from some Palestinians in the war-ravaged strip on this latest ICJ ruling.
Humanitarian conditions are miserable. We want a solution. We need a solution. The aid that goes to northern Gaza does not reach the needy ones, while the aid that arrives in the southern Gaza is being sold in the markets in retail or wholesale.
It was a courageous and good decision by the International Court of Justice, but will Israel abide by the ruling? Israel considers itself to be above the law. Humanitarian conditions in Gaza are not hidden. It is very miserable, prices are very high, and there is no monitoring of prices. Businessmen put the prices they wish, and they are not being controlled by the Ministry of Economy or any law.
The order came very late. The war has been ongoing for about 6 months, and now the International Court of Justice has found out that the people are on the verge of starvation. What we care about is implementing this order. But is there anyone to pressure Israel to implement it? I don't think so.
Israeli forces carried out fresh raids throughout the occupied West Bank overnight, leaving a teenager dead and several other young Palestinians injured. Now, a victim identified as 13-year-old Muatsem Nabil Abu Abed was hit by Israeli live fire during a military incursion into the Kabatia town near the city of Jenin. Two others were injured in the same raid, with one reported in serious condition. Clashes also broke out after Palestinian youth resisted Israeli raids on the cities of Qalqilia and Ariha. Now, there were similar clashes in the town of Beit Amir, where a 13-year-old child was injured by shrapnel and dozens of others suffered tear gas inhalation. Palestinians in the occupied territories have endured violent Israeli raids almost on a daily basis since onset of the regime's genocidal war on Gaza. Our correspondent, Mona Candil, earlier joined us out of Ramallah with more details about Israel's latest violent raids on several West Bank cities and towns.
This time, before dawn, the Israeli forces stormed Kabatia town, southern the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, and killed 13-year-old Muatsem Nabil Abed from Kabatia and wounded at least one other, and he's in serious condition. Before the Israeli forces stormed Kabatia town, the undercover units had sneaked into the town of Kabatia, and then when they were discovered, Israeli forces were sent and they stormed the Kabatia town. Two Palestinians were arrested, a father and his son, and the Israeli soldiers stormed a number of homes there in Kabatia and caused a severe damage in the properties of these houses. At least two more Palestinians were beaten during the operation in Kabatia town. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli forces stormed the town of Tobas, and during this operation in Tobas, exchange of fire have taken place as well.
Thousands of Jordanians have marched toward the Israeli embassy in the capital Amman for a sixth consecutive night in solidarity with Palestinians. Protesters slammed Israeli crimes, especially attacks on hospitals. They waved Palestinian and Jordanian flags and called for an end to Jordan's unpopular peace treaty with Tel Aviv. They also urged the government to expel the Israeli ambassador from Amman. A demonstrator's voice support for Palestinian resistance groups as well and the people of Gaza.
We will not let down the people in Gaza and Palestine. This nation will always be beside Palestine and will always have its voice high to defend the Palestinian case and support our people in Gaza to defend the resistance which defends our right in Palestine.
Jordanian security forces have in recent days broken up several such demonstrations with tear gas and made arrests and also left a number of people injured. Jordan, which hosts over 2.4 million Palestinian refugees, has witnessed numerous pro-Palestine rallies since Israel launched its onslaught on Gaza in early October. Tens of thousands of Yemenis once again take to the streets of the capital, Sana'a, and other cities to reaffirm their full support for oppressed people of Palestine. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has your details.
On the third Friday of Ramadan, tens of thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Sana'a and several other cities, renewing their unwavering support for Palestinians. Some held banners that read, "We are entering the 10th year and the Palestinian cause remains our priority."
We're entering the 10th year of our resistance against an all-out war on the Yemeni people. We are here today to show our continued support for the Palestinians in Gaza and across the occupied territories. When the countries that possess enormous military capabilities failed to support the Palestinians in Gaza and even conspired with the Israeli regime against them, the war-stricken Yemenis came out to support their oppressed brothers. They left the world in awe with a united front and a soaring popularity in the region.
Protesters chanted slogans vowing to retaliate against the U.S. and the U.K. airstrikes on the Yemeni cities. They also pledged to escalate their naval operations as long as the Israeli onslaught on Palestinians and the aggression against Yemen continue. Yemenis also slammed the United Nations Security Council for its failure to put an end to the Israeli atrocities in Palestine, despite its recent ceasefire resolution.
We consider the Security Council complicit in the ongoing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. The United States manipulates the Security Council and the United Nations based on its interests. That is why the U.S. used its veto power three times to prevent a ceasefire in Gaza. But besides that, the Security Council resolutions are ineffective in ending the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in Gaza.
The problem is not with the Security Council or the United Nations, but with the United States, which has the power to control and manipulate these international organizations. There are many binding decisions that have not been implemented because Washington uses its power against the weak and oppressed people of the world. It is necessary to find an effective mechanism for the Security Council because there are many countries that are yearning to be liberated from the Western hegemony. The events that the world is witnessing in some African countries are a clear proof for this desire for change.
On Thursday, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, criticized the U.S. and the U.K. for exploiting the humanitarian situation in Yemen. He slammed them for threatening to cut the U.N.-provided aid to Yemenis in order to stop the country's naval operations. Al-Houthi asserted that, according to the U.S. officers, the American Navy has not faced such a humiliation in the international waters since the 19th century.
Neither the military aggression against Yemen nor the cessation of the supply for humanitarian aid has succeeded in halting Yemen's naval operations. Furthermore, officials state that the ongoing Western aggression only serves to motivate the Yemeni army to continue enhancing its capabilities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
U.S. has in recent days quietly authorized a transfer of billions of dollars in bombs and fighter jets to Israel. U.S. officials say the new arms package includes over 1,800 bombs. Now, these are 2,000-pound bombs that could demolish entire city blocks and are almost never used in populated areas. Israel, however, has used them extensively throughout Gaza. Last week, the State Department also authorized transfer of 25 F-35 fighter jets and their engines to Israel. Earlier reports said that U.S. had quietly made over 100 weapon sales to Israel, Since the Gaza onslaught started back on October 7th, armed supplies go against the U.S. call for a Gaza ceasefire. A French firm has been accused of providing arms components to Israel that are being used against civilians in Gaza. Nearly a ton of parts needed for use in Israeli and NATO machine guns were apparently shipped back in October in what leftist French parliamentarians have termed a massive scandal. Rami Mazahiri has your details out of Paris.
A new report from a French investigative website alleges that France is supplying arms components for use by the Israeli army in Gaza. Nearly a ton of parts for machine guns was sent in October to Israel by a French firm whose parts have already been discovered in Syria, Somalia, and elsewhere. The parts are for the type of weapon which has been used by Israel in many of their recent massacres of Palestinians. The French government responded that the parts are being used by Israel only for use in arms manufacturing for foreign customers, but many find that explanation hard to believe. Opposition lawmakers have called it a massive scandal and accused the defense minister of lying before Parliament. France claims that the only weapons authorized for export to Israel are for purely defensive purposes. But activists say there is a lack of transparency in the arms export information, which the government declassifies, and an overall lack of honesty.
C'est une plaisanterie de mauvais goût.
These quote-unquote explanations of the French government are a joke and in very bad taste. How on earth can we possibly believe that machine guns are a defensive weapon? However, this is very much in keeping with the national policy, which is total collaboration with and cover for the regime of Israel.
Spain, the Netherlands, Japan, and Canada have recently banned all arms exports to Israel, and pressure is mounting for all Western nations to follow suit. Multiple top NGOs say that France is violating international treaties it has signed by continuing to supply military equipment to Israel, even though it seems clear that these arms are being used to commit genocide, crimes against humanity, and other war crimes.
The complicity of France with the Israeli genocidal regime is continuing, even despite the emotion and the anger generated by the mass murder of tens of thousands of people in Gaza. We shouldn't be fooled when Paris rarely, and only rarely, modifies its tone slightly towards Tel Aviv, because its actions are 99% against the Palestinians.
The French arms dealers, Eurolynx, who since 1950 have supplied the French army with weapons parts for use in places like Algeria, Vietnam, and elsewhere, is expected to come under massive local protests in the coming weeks. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Gaza is still under a relentless Israeli regime attack. Hunger is worsening. For so many people, the first week of Ramadan has been spent in tents. The atmosphere of this special month is missing. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The people of Gaza had hoped that the genocidal war would stop before Ramadan. Everybody needed to feel safe, to have food and water, and to move through the streets without fearing explosions. An estimated 1.7 million displaced people had hoped they could return to their homes and inspect what was left of them. They had hopes, too, of being reunited with neighbors and friends. None of these hopes have been realized. Gaza is still under a relentless Israeli attack. Hunger is worsening. For so many people, the first week of Ramadan has been spent in tents. The atmosphere of this special month is missing. Salim Al-Masri, 40, has been uprooted from Gaza City. He is now in Al-Mawasi, southern Gaza," he said. "There are no words to express the sadness in our hearts." He reminisces about how he celebrated Ramadan in the past. He decorated every room in his home so that everyone who entered it could feel cheerful. And he meticulously planned the meals that preceded and followed the daily fasts. He said, "I would spend hours in the streets where the markets were. My children would run in between the shops. All of this was taken away from us because of the war. I feel like I'm suffocating here, sitting in this tent. It's a small space, not big enough for me, my wife, and the children." While he previously took pride in having a table brimming with various dishes for his family in Ramadan, prices are now so high that he could not even provide them with one type of food. Wafa Akbar, 52, is from the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Her home has been destroyed, and she laments how she will not be able to prepare meals as she traditionally did during Ramadan. After being displaced, she is now further south in Rafah, near the border with Egypt. She said, "I will never get used to living in a tent. The tent is full of sand, and I have no privacy." She added, "I have no kitchen or kitchen utensils, and I have no food apart from canned food, which I don't like to eat." She is especially sad that she cannot spend time with her grandchildren this Ramadan. She said, "We are all scattered." Jude Barbak, 12, is from Gaza City but now living in Al-Mawasi. She recalls going to school feeling sleepy at Ramadan because she used to stay up all the night. Once darkness fell, she would buy ice cream and other treats. She was especially fond of samosas. She said, "I used to compete with my friends to see who had the most beautiful decorations in their house." She added, "I miss everything. Being in a tent is like being in a prison." Meanwhile, Al Jazeera English reported, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom said, "Children are dying from the effects of malnutrition and disease and from a lack of adequate water and sanitation in Gaza." He said, "The future of an entire generation is in serious peril. Once again, we ask Israel to open more crossings and accelerate the entry and delivery of water, food, medical supplies, and other humanitarian aid into and within Gaza. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime has continued blocking most aid trucks from entering Gaza by land. Since its offensive began on October 7th, Israel has barred the entry of food, water, medicine, and other basic supplies except for a tiny trickle of aid entering the south from Egypt at the Rafah crossing and Karam Abu Salem crossing. Aid agencies and health officials in Gaza have warned that this is not nearly enough to cover the needs of nearly 2.3 million people in the enclave, especially those in northern Gaza, where famine is imminent. According to Philip Lazzarini, head of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, famine is likely to occur by May in northern Gaza and could spread across the enclave by July. The world's hunger watchdog, known as the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, said earlier this week. Tedros said WHO requests to deliver supplies to the enclave were often blocked or refused.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. Israel has carried out its deadliest attacks in months on Syria, leaving dozens of people dead. The aggression has coincided with a drone attack launched by terrorists in Idlib. Israel has also ramped up its deadly airstrikes on Lebanon in recent days. This is while the regime is pressing ahead with its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, and there seems to be no end in sight to the nearly six-month assault despite growing international pressure. On this edition of Spotlight, we'll try to find out why Israel is trying to increase tensions and what would be the repercussions of such an escalation for the entire region and beyond. Our guests on tonight's Spotlight are international human rights defender Ziad Ebrahim Patel, joining us from Johannesburg. And we also have human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi joining us from Houston, Texas. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Patel in Johannesburg. It's great to have you with us, sir. Now, Israel, as we mentioned in our intros, launched a fresh attack on Syria, targeting a number of locations in the northwestern city of Aleppo. The attack has left a number of civilians and military personnel dead. It's damaged public and private property. Now, the Syrian military said the Israeli aggression coincided with a drone attack by terrorist organizations launched from Idlib and the western countryside of Aleppo. As the massacre in Gaza rages on, how do you perceive the Israelis' actions in other areas of the region? And how much of this increased aggression would you say is tied to Israel's failures in Gaza?
Good evening, and thank you for having me on your show. Yes, indeed, this is the normal course of action that Israel has been doing over many years. And as the war rages, quite rightly, in Gaza, in fact, the genocide as it rages quite in Gaza, Israel is feeling the pressure. It's feeling the pressure of the resistance movements that have continued unabated, as Israel has continued unabated in its atrocities and crimes against Palestinians. And we got to put this in context, that all these extraterritorial attacks are unlawful under international law. To conduct these strikes in Syria And again, we got to look at, you know, what was military advantage and compared to what, you know, what human causation. In other words, what was the human beings that were lost in this? You know, they would call this the... So, for instance, human beings and innocent are always caught up in this conflict, unfortunately. But this continues, and Israel, we must hold Israel to account. But unfortunately, this is the situation because Israel feels that it's losing control in terms of its fight against the resistance movements and will try to suppress and equalize where it perceives threats to be. And that's why we're seeing this increased attacks in the region.
Moussa Naghvi, let's also focus on the growing tensions between Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement and forces of the Israeli regime. The Israelis have targeted a vehicle in the city of Tyre with a drone, leaving one Lebanese dead. Hezbollah has also carried out retaliatory missile strikes on Israeli positions in the occupied territories. Are the Israelis actively pursuing more tensions in the region, and how do they benefit from this?
I think this is a sign of Israel being very vulnerable and a sign of them being weak. So because they're being defeated in the Gaza Strip, the solution that they're trying to come up with is to expand the war in the region, to create chaos in the region. And that's why we see them acting so erratically, where now they've attacked Syria. The fighting on the northern front with Hezbollah has been happening since October 7th, in which many of Hezbollah's fighters have been martyred. But Hezbollah has also been retaliating to strategically retaliating to Israel's attacks as well. And as a matter of fact, I wouldn't be exaggerating in stating that the role that Hezbollah has played on the northern front has led to thousands. Over 10,000 settlers evacuating from that part of occupied Palestine. So Hezbollah is playing that very key role. So it is quite clear that just how Israel sees Hamas as a threat, just like they see Syria as a threat, they see Hezbollah as a threat equivalent to that of Palestinian freedom fighters. So in short, if we summarize and if we conclude that the Zionist regime of Israel considers the axis of resistance as a threat, as a genuine threat to its very existence, then we can understand the attacks on Israel. We can understand the constant attacks on the southern front in Lebanon as well. And ironically and unfortunately, the Zionist regime, another sign of their weakness is that for the most part, their targets are usually civilians, may that be in Palestine, Syria, or even Lebanon. Whereas the resistance front has always focused on targeting military personnel. And adding to the point that my colleague made earlier about Syria, I think it's important to note that the fact that Idlib, the attack of terrorists in Idlib, seemed almost coordinated with Israel's attacks, goes on to show that these splinter groups, these terrorist groups who've been operating in Idlib, who were operating in Syria, and they were kicked out by Hezbollah in Syria, have always been a proxy of the U.S. empire and the Zionist regime. They've always served their purpose. So those who are criticizing Hezbollah of intervening in Israel, in Syria, now understand and now know why Syria has always been of such great importance to the axis of resistance.
Mr. Patel, how important has this unified response been from the resistance front in the region? There's Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq, resistance groups in Syria. Were the Israelis in Washington expecting that from all of the resistance fronts in the region?
I think we all know that Palestine has been in a state of resistance for several decades, undergoing belligerent military occupation in the occupied Palestinian territories and in occupied Palestine at large. We've always known, and I mean the enemies of Palestine, the Americans, the Israelis, I've always known that there are certain groups that will be steadfast to the standing with the resistance of Palestine, which is a fundamental right under international law, because the right to resistance is strongly associated to the right of self-determination, and Palestinians need to exert that right. So I think in some cases they may have been surprised by the broadening of the axis of resistance, as we've seen the Houthi Yemenis in Yemen, closure of the Red Sea, the stopping of ships in that area, and stopping that kind of cargo, which is a very good BDS campaign. And then we've seen the axis of resistance, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, northern occupied Palestine, and of course in Syria and Iraq. And that needs to broaden. We need to look at this also from the context that we've got Arab countries around Palestine, Syria, Jordan, Jordan, Egypt, and other countries that have normalized. Some countries have normalized with the Zionist regime. And we've seen that there's been no real military intervention despite the carnage in Gaza. And just coming back to my previous point, and I think it's important what my colleague mentioned, is that in all of the attacks by these terror groups and Israel and backed by the U.S., and of course we must also remember that the European Union and European Union countries sell huge and license huge volumes of arms to Israel. And this is being used indiscriminately for many years, since I think the 2009 war, when we lodged the first docket criminal complaint against Israel with South African authorities. We had focused on war crimes, where Israel has perpetually used indiscriminate use of force and indistinction of military target to civilian population. That has continued. Israel continues to be criminally responsible for egregious crimes, such as crimes against humanity, crimes of apartheid, torture, forced displacement, and many other crimes. And of course, now we see genocide. Whereas the armed resistance of armed resistance groups have had focused, targeted areas. And I think when we look at this, it needs to be looked at, is it from the perspective of international law, and what are the laws of war, and what must, you know, what must be complied with, and what are the levels that a certain use of force right. must comply with, or do we need to look at it from an Islamic perspective of what our responsibilities are? And I think the resistance groups are very conscious of the Islamic responsibilities in terms of conflict and how to, ward off the aggressor in these instances.
Yes, let's go back to Mr. Nahvi. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has defiantly vowed to go ahead with this military campaign, this genocidal massacre, saying that the international pressure on his regime will not work. Have all the years of impunity and U.S. cover for Israel made this child-killing regime believe that it's actually above the law and it's safe from accountability?
Absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt about that, that the Zionist regime, independent of the U.S., is nothing. It has no power. The only reason why the Zionist regime has been imposed on the region of West Asia is because of the support that it gains from the U.S. Within the international community. We now see that the European Union is also taking a very clear stance in shifting away from being a party to the Zionist, the Israeli Zionist crimes that they're committing in Gaza today. We see them taking a slightly different line from the Zionist regime. But the one country that we still see to date that unequivocally supports the Israeli regime, may that be militarily, may that be diplomatically, may that be in the international arena in the United Nations, that is the United States of America. So now it makes sense when Imam Khomeini said that America is the great Satan, that America is Shaitan and Buzurg. When Imam Khomeini said that, many must have not understood that statement before. But it is now seen, we can now conclude that the statement that was made by Imam Khomeini, it had a lot of wisdom in it.
the Zionist regime is not the real issue, but it is rather the policies of the U.S. empire that has empowered this weak, this so-called state, this occupying power, which is as weak as the spider's web in that region. And another statement that I would like to make in addition to the previous question that was asked a few minutes back is that when the Zionist regime tries to target military personnel from Hezbollah, like they targeted Shahid Ali Abdul Hassan Naim, who was one of the leaders of the heavy warhead rocket fire unit of Hezbollah, they need to understand that, and they already know, but just to kind of reiterate for the audience, is that Hezbollah is a very organized, it's an organized military giant in the region now. They thought that they'll be able to weaken Hezbollah when Imad Mughniyeh was martyred. They thought that after Jihad Mughniyeh is martyred, when Shahid Badruddin is martyred, or when Shahid Abbas Musawi or Sheikh Raghib or Hadi Nasrullah, when they're martyred, Hezbollah will become weak. But history has shown us that the school of martyrdom within Hezbollah has only strengthened Hezbollah and has made them into the giant that they are today. They are so organized that they work in ways that they always have parallel leaderships within their divisions, like any other sure. military power.
Mr. Patel, Hamas has hailed a ruling by the International Court of Justice ordering the Israeli regime to address famine in Gaza. The reaction came after the ICJ ordered Israel to allow the immediate delivery of humanitarian supplies into Gaza. Hamas has called on the international community to create a mechanism to ensure the order's implementation. How do you see that happening? What would be step one, in your opinion?
Yes, I think this is an important development. And to give your viewers context, I think South Africa has been busy with this since January or December, when the hearings initially started at the International Court of Justice. The application was made. And in fact, the ICJ has now issued three orders in terms of provisional measures. Initially, the provisional measures were very clear and succinct that there needs to be a humanitarian corridor and there needs to be access to aid. And that was one of the conditions. We saw the United States and Israel use it in a different way. They've used the Hasbara and the spin on the order, stating that the word ceasefire was not included. But the order could not be effected without an effective ceasefire because of the humanitarian aid that was required at scale. Subsequently to that, South Africa requested further measures to the International Court of Justice, and the response from the ICJ was that no further provisional measures were required. Israel was bound to the initial order that was given by the court. And just recently, the order based on famine and starvation, we know that the catastrophic situation that now exists in Gaza. Northern Gaza is effectively now separated from southern Gaza. Netanyahu has spoken about a demilitarized zone, which means effectively more belligerent military occupation. And certainly that famine and starvation is a serious problem. South Africa in its application stated that there's almost a concern for about 80,000 civilian deaths that are imminent if this problem is not, seriously redressed, as there's imminent harm to a civilian population. And of course, there was also the UN rapporteur that came out with a report, An Anatomy of a Genocide, claiming that Israel is guilty of at least three of the five acts in terms of the Genocide Convention. So the international pressure is mounting. The international community has spoken clearly through the General Assembly. Unfortunately, the UN Security Council has always been politicized, and we've seen the number of vetoes that the US has exercised. But my view, and I've just come back from Tehran recently, is that there's nothing stopping Islamic states or Muslim countries from intervening in this crisis. And in fact, my belief is that they should have intervened from the very outset, because we know that Israel is now a ultra-right Zio-fascist government, and they've been hell-bent on the destruction of the Palestinian population. We're not only seeing this genocide unfold in Gaza, but also the increased raids in the occupied Palestinian territories. So Muslim countries and countries should intervene, but they need to be politically enabled and not be politically influenced and controlled, unfortunately, by the Western powers that have neutralized them. That is the reality of the fact, that they've been actively neutralized. Indeed. Only way that we're being able to see any movement is through the resistance or the axis of resistance, but they're not going to be able to provide the humanitarian aid at scale. So I think we've got to insist on the international measures and the international community to force Israel to comply with the International Court of Justice orders, that humanitarian aid be delivered,
right,
that access to borders be opened, and that it be provided to the needs of the Gazan population.
Mohsen Naavi, we're running short of time, but I want you to discuss a video that surfaced showing Israeli forces executing unarmed Palestinians near Gaza's coast. They were waving white flags in a show of surrender. The Israeli soldiers, after murdering them, they went on to bury their bodies in the sand with a bulldozer. Is this a clear indication that this genocidal massacre has not only been a war against Gaza's resistance, but actually against all of its people?
Absolutely. The resistance has simply been used as a pretext. The civilians in Gaza have not, this is not recent. This war did not start after October 7th, as most of the world might think. But this genocide against the innocent civilians of Gaza is exactly why you now have freedom fighters in the shape of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades, who are now defending the very rights of their people. And also I would like to reiterate the fact that to go down on such low levels, to assault and to disrespect civilians in such a manner can only be expected of the Zionist regime, and only goes on to show how weak they are. That because they cannot fight like real men, they can't fight the military, they can't fight Palestinian freedom fighters, they exert their frustration and their pressure on innocent civilians by disrespecting and insulting them like this. But they need to understand that the Zionist regime is only exposing themselves when they act in such a manner.
Okay, I'm sorry. We're running short of time now. Allow me to thank my guests, Ziad Ibrahim Patel, international human rights defender, joining us from Johannesburg, and human rights activist Mohsen Naavi, speaking to us from Houston, Texas. Thank you, gentlemen, and also allow me to thank our viewers for staying with us on tonight. Spotlight is good night for now, and see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو إذا الرحمن
Allah
هو إذا المنان
لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. For today's discussion, we have invited Sheikh Rouhani and a special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom to answer questions related to Islamic beliefs. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, 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 you'll find your way.
The concept of Zuhur, or the reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi ajalallah, is one of the most important topics, a very controversial topic. There are so many explanations and commentaries written on the concept of Zuhur. Now, the main question for today's discussion is that, can our deeds be considered as obstacles on the way of the reappearance of Imam As, or our deeds, our good deeds, hasten the reappearance of Imam As?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, our deeds have the influence on the reappearance of the Imam al-Asr wa Fida. According to one of the tawqi'at, or one of the hadith narrated from the holy Imam al-Asr wa Fida, in this hadith it is clearly mentioned that some of the deeds of the people and the followers of the Imam will have the impact on the delay on his reappearance. For example, if the sinful people, or the number of sinful people, increased and people did not pay attention a lot to purify themselves from sins, and of course this increasing or enhancing the, let's say, number of sins in the society, among the people, it will had a very negative impact on the Zuhur and reappearance of Imam al-Asr wa Huna Fida. And then the other point that is mentioned in this riwayah and this tawqiyah, the Holy Imam says that if walau anna ashya'ana waffaqahum Allah li ta'atihi, he says that if the followers of us, the followers of Ahlul Bayt, they will be successfully following Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, obeying Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and be united and be mindful of their promises, to fulfill their promises, and of course to be righteous, to be actually good, doers and followers of the Islamic teachings and let's say, instructions, then in this case, of course, it will hasten our reappearance according to this riwayah. So the opposite of this means that if the Shiite and the followers of the Imam be disunited, or if they actually they commit lots of sins, for example, if they do not fulfill their promises, if they will not be righteous, of course, if they not be careful about doing good, or let's say amr bil ma'ruf wa nahy anil munkar, enjoining good and forbidding evils, then of course in that case it will have its negative impact on the reappearance and zuhur of the Imam alayhi salatu wassalam. And the other point that is mentioned in this tawqi' is this, that Imam alayhi salatu wassalam says this, tadhi'u haqqullah wa haqqun nas, if the people became transgressors and do not care about the rights of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the rights of the people. In this case, since the people violate these rights, divine rights, and also the rights of the people, of course, it will delay and postpone the reappearance of the Imam. These are some of the signs that are mentioned in this tawqi' and hadith from the Holy Imam, alayhi salatu wassalam.
Sorry, Sheikh, isn't this in contradiction with setting a time from the side of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? I mean, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for sure has arranged a timing, a specific timing for the zuhur and the reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi. So why, for example, some of our deeds might hasten or put an obstacle on the way of the reappearance of zuhur of Imam As?
Of course, the time is, according to what we understand from the ayat and riwayat, the time is, of course, is Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala set a time, but it is like conditional time. It depends that, for example, we have sometimes something is muqaddar, something is decided, but it is always dependent on certain items or certain things. That if, for example, such and such a thing happened, then of course that thing will happen. So this is kind of conditional sort of timing that is set. As we know that in the riwayat, in the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, it's mentioned explicitly that, for example, istighfar, asking forgiveness from Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by the people. And of course, ri'aya of haqqun nas, ri'aya of haqqullah, observing the rights of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, observing the right of the people, and of course, to be united, to be, let's say, supportive of each other. These are some of the signs that are mentioned in our riwayat that they will hasten the reappearance of the Imam. So that's why, based on this tawqiyah, we understand that though the timing is in a specific time, but it seems that it has two aspects, that if, for example, the people try their best to ask forgiveness, to be united, to be mindful of the rights of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and rights of the people, it has a good, a positive kind of impact on the reappearance of the Imam, which means that it may hasten the reappearance of the Imam. It means that if the people become good people, prepared and ready to accept the Imam, you know, because when the Imam comes, of course, he will come in a society, he will have the people to support him, to follow him, to accept him. The people should have this capability and capacity to accept the divine orders of the Imam, help him, to support him, to follow him. It seems that if ma'asi and sins are increased and the people become very much sinful, they do not care about anything. So, of course, in that kind of situation, the reappearance of the Imam will not be useful and helpful for these people.
Okay.
At least a number of people or a number of societies or nations should be ready for accepting the Imam and following the Imam and supporting him. That's why it seems that sin is one of the main, let's say, factor that has its own impact on the reappearance of the Imam.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions.
in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
And sometimes a contradiction is found, Shaykh, in the concept of